David Waters. Here on FM, in Book of the Week, Jamie Parker continues reading from Epilogue, a memoir. American writer Will Boast's extraordinary family story about grief and finding a way to face the future. The more the author learns about his newfound family in England, the more difficult it becomes to shy away from certain aspects of his late father's past.
Christmas in England. Presents at 10 in the morning. Roast goose, roast potatoes, roast parsnips, sausages wrapped in bacon. I eat too much, drink too much of the slow gin Auntie Jan and her husband John bring down to Southampton. I pull my cracker, unroll the paper crown, and sit smiling with it on my head. At 7, cheese and biscuits, then a few games of Scrabble before we settle down to the inevitable Doctor Who special on telly. It's not a bad day. I know it's not meant to make me personally feel miserable. Everyone, they say, gets depressed around Christmas. Nanny and I were watching University Challenge. She'd answered more of the sadistically obscure questions than any of the cabbage-pale Oxbridge contestants. My grandmother in her sea-green recliner, adjusting her bifocals, primping the curls of her perm, making little gestures of delight every time she got a question right. Seeing her was always a comfort to me. But now my toes were wriggling in my shoes. I kept getting up to check the time. And when the doorbell went just before 8, I nearly leapt out of my seat, I was so startled. I went to the door, opened it, held out my hand. Harry was tall, a couple of inches taller than me, with dark brown eyes and thick brown hair, curly and neatly kept. He wore khakis and a crisply pressed short-sleeve shirt. I had on one of my threadbare Western wear snap-ups, but there was no mistaking it. Arthur was the son of my father, but here before me was my brother. We looked more alike than even Rory and I had. We crossed the Itchen and drove along Southampton Water, hardly speaking. Harry turned onto a dark, narrow lane and parked under a copse of willows. A path led to a wooden gate and stone steps going down. I could hear waves lapping against pilings, a sound that took me back to Fontana and the lake and touched something wide and lonesome inside me. A marina opened up below us. A flock of white sailboats, masts ticking back and forth against the inky water. A sudden panic trilled through me. What were we doing here, at night in this out-of-the-way place? I saw the pub at the bottom of the steps. No big-screen TVs, no fruit machines. The copper beer taps shone invitingly. We took a table in the corner. Harry sipped his pint and stared across the water, a vigilant look on his face, as if he were trying to spot something out there in the dark. Used to bring Rose here when we first started dating. Like to come for lunch, watch the boats going out. We sat drinking our beer. It felt like the end of a conversation, not the beginning. "Arthur tells me you're a Saints fanatic," I said. "He told you about the turnstile, did he?" "Sorry?" "Well, Rose let me have it on condition I put it in the garden. He explained that he'd bought at auction one of the entrance turnstiles from the Dell, Southampton's former grounds. He'd put in 8 bids before he'd won the lot." "How much was it in the end?"
$3,000.
Harry went on, telling me that when the Saints played their last match at the Dell, he and a few other season ticket holders had unbolted their seats and lugged them home. He'd also bought a square of turf from the pitch and planted it in the back garden next to the turnstile. "How do you tell the Dell grass from the grass grass?" "Turf died 2 weeks later." It was like having a pleasant chat with a distant acquaintance, except that every time I looked at him, I saw my chin, my nose, my jaw.
Do you like to cook?
I asked Harry.
Andrew loved to cook.
I was reluctant to bring up my dad. His dad, our dad, I didn't even know what to call him anymore. He was really good at Indian. I remember his lime pickle. It was so hot, only he ever wanted to eat it. But he always made us sit down, have a proper family meal together.
Harry watched as a boat, probably the last to come in that day, glided into the marina. Some memory seemed to glide past his eyes as well. For a moment, I recognized Rory in him.
We drove to Harry's house. After we'd said our hellos, Harry, Rose, and I sat down in the living room. The kids kept their distance, studiously investigating the toys I'd brought. We opened a bottle of wine. I rambled on for a while about the Midwest, grad school, bands I'd played in. All of it sounded completely frivolous as soon as it passed my lips. Violet, the younger kid, got down on all fours and neighed like a horse. Charlie asked if he could bring out his cornet and play a song, but Harry gently said no. Charlie and Violet were performing for me, that much was clear, but I never knew how to act or what to say around kids. Charlie came over again. He looked up at me under his delicate lashes with his bright blue eyes.
"Uncle Will, why do you talk that way?"
He meant my American accent, but all I could think was, "Uncle Will." Until that moment, it hadn't occurred to me that, properly speaking, this little boy and girl were my niece and nephew. After the kids were in bed, we sat down with another bottle of wine. Rose tucked her legs underneath her and snuggled closer to Harry.
"And your parents never told you?" she asked me. "They never told you that you had half-brothers?"
I'd racked my brains trying to remember, I said. If there was ever a hint dropped and I just didn't understand, I'd looked for photos. There wasn't a single one. It was like that part of my dad's life just stopped existing for him. Rose turned to Harry.
"I must have felt, well, like you'd just been discarded."
That word rang out, discarded. Whether my dad had walked out on his first family or Helen had forced him out, the effect had been the same. Arthur and Harry's dad disappeared from their lives completely. Eventually, he took up with another woman, started another family, then moved out of the country, first to Ireland, then all the way to America. To Arthur and Harry growing up, it would have felt as if he wanted to get as far from them as possible. And now, here I was, telling Harry his dad hadn't kept even a single photo of him. I saw him struggling to speak, but the words wouldn't come. At 7:30 in the morning on a Saturday, Mom and I would arrive together at the library. It was the basement of the village hall, all acoustic tile, wood paneling, and worn-down teal carpet, made more inviting by a few mismatched lamps and the comfy leather chairs in the atrium. The sour stink of the vinegar Mrs. Jansen, the fastidious, bookishly glamorous head librarian, used to clean the coffee urn, hung in the air. As it faded, the smell of the books rose, dry and earthy. I was 12, almost 13, and they smelled to me like jumping into a pile of fall leaves. Mom and I stood in the half-dark, letting the library wake up with us. To one side of the circulation desk stood my task, 8 or 9 carts of returns, often more, waiting to be reshelved. I'd start in trivia, a couple of shelves of hefty paperbacks that went in and out of the library quickly, the World Almanac, Ripley's Believe It or Not, the Book of Lists, the new Book of Lists, best Book of Lists ever. Sitting on my rolling footstool, I couldn't help a quick look. On his famous flight, Charles Lindbergh took with him 4 sandwiches. The common housefly always hums in the key of F.
At 8:30, the library opened, and if there weren't a few patrons already waiting in their cars, they started arriving soon after, the retirees who'd been up since 5, coming in to sit in the atrium in the sunlight and read the Trib, the harried mothers hustling through to check out videos for their kids before soccer practice. You could hardly keep people away. I listened to the burbling of the coffee urn, the old man rustling newspapers or snoring in the atrium, the clacking of the bulky blue-gray IBM Selectric Mom used to type out catalog cards. Our patrons' tastes did not run to the literary. We're talking here about a library in a small Midwestern town where people like 799.2 hunting, 796.94 snowmobiling, and sitting around in ice fishing cabins all day waiting on fish, see 362.2 insanity. By 8th grade, I'd spent enough time reshelving in outdoor sports to make me a vicarious enthusiast on all these subjects. It was summer, and girls from my school had been coming into the library. Hiding in the stacks, I caught glimpses through the shelves, a sun-tanned arm, a book-sized slice of thigh, while I played at doing my job, shuttling back and forth on my stool to get a better look. They'd check out Adventures in Babysitting, R.L. Stine, Flowers in the Attic, back issues of 17. I could picture them lying on towels at the beach or the country club pool, books or magazines tented over suntan oil glistening bellies. At story time, my mom wore a purple ball gown with a gray wig, a fairy godmother, Good Witch of the West costume, depending on the story, Cinderella, The Wizard of Oz, Puss in Boots, Jack and the Beanstalk. The tots sat Indian style on the teal carpet, staring wide-eyed while Mom hammed it up, delivering the dialogue in a posh accent. "Oh, I say, hasn't this beanstalk grown tall?" She wasn't paid for story hour. She often went in and did it on her days off. The library was her refuge. It never changed. Always the smell of slightly toasted dust, the dark wood paneling, the worn-out carpet, the sedate voices and deliberate movements of the other librarians. Years later, I stopped in Fontana to see the library. Stepping inside, for the first time in 12 years, I hardly recognized the place. The carpet was new, and the circulation desk was now a big, shining swoop of lacquered maple with brass trim. I introduced myself to the librarian on duty. I told her I used to work here with my mom. "Oh, Nancy Bost. You knew her?" "Honey, everyone knew your mom." I passed through the double doors back into the sharp winter air. She was still there, in the chat over the circulation desk that only starts in whispers, the wide eyes of children at story time. The smell of dust and paper and morning light. She's there when the book falls open, almost by itself, and I can't help myself, without pausing to think about what I could be doing next. I start to read.
Jamie Parker was reading Epilogue, a memoir by Will Bost. The book was abridged by Miranda Emerson and produced by Gemma Jenkins. Woman's Hour is after the news. First, here's Kate Hady.
You never know what you're going to get when you tune in to From Our Own Correspondent, where you might be taken, what you might learn, what you might laugh at. Almost anything goes. It could be on-the-spot insight into a major story. But many memorable pieces emerge from the other end of the news spectrum. Reflections, perhaps, on the closure of an old newspaper in a sleepy corner of Iran, on the use of English in French pop songs, or the attitude towards waiters in seaside restaurants in Albania. You never know what you'll get, but you can be sure of good writing and good storytelling. From Our Own Correspondent returns to Thursday mornings on BBC Radio 4. I hope you'll join me, Kate Adie, this morning at 11.